Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. How tough is it to be a government whistleblower these days? A dozen years after 9/11, with a former constitutional law professor in the White House, the sad news is that to expose government negligence or illegality is to jeopardize your career and your life savings. The newest documentary from producer-director Robert Greenwald and Brave New Films, War on Whistleblowers, Free Press, and the National Security State, highlights the stories of four individuals who felt compelled to reveal acts of government illegality and violations of the U.S. Constitution in the military-industrial complex. In the film, whistleblowers, journalists, and experts share how the government punishes those who stand up to demand accountability and defend the Constitution. Such actions and the atmosphere that they engender has a chilling effect on the speech rights of citizens and the free press. Today, I'll speak about all of this with Robert Greenwald, and in the second half, we'll be joined by two of the courageous whistleblowers featured in the film. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives and the work and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, and culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Robert Greenwald, founder and president of Brave New Films, has produced and or directed more than 50 TV movies and miniseries. Documentaries produced by Brave New Films have been streamed across all seven continents and have been viewed over 70 million times and counting. At Brave New Films, Greenwald has produced and directed Uncovered, The War in Iraq, Outfoxed, Rupert Murdoch's War on Journalism, Walmart, The High Cost of Low Price, Iraq for Sale, The War Profiteers, Rethink Afghanistan, Koch Brothers Exposed, and his latest, War on Whistleblowers. Welcome again, Robert Greenwald, to Free Forum.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be with you.
Great, Robert. As you may know, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So I just did a quick bit of bio, but could you tell us in your own words a bit about your path, and feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision. How did you get started in film and television, and then what led to your leaving that world for the work that you do today?
Well, I'll try to keep it in under 5 hours, my answer. I actually began working in the theater in New York, where I worked off Broadway, then got a job to move out here and directed plays at the Mark Taper Forum, and I discovered one thing very quickly, which I have some skills, but the skill I don't have is being a good employee. So I needed to pretty quickly start something of my own, and I was fascinated by film and TV, so I decided to start a film and television company, having no idea how impossible it is, but I did. And that's when I made, over a period of time, and it was not easy, but did lots of TV movies and cable movies and miniseries and feature films over many years, and was enjoyed it enormously, and then reached a turning point in which two events happened around the same time. One was the death of my father, in which I remember thinking about what I was going to say when I got up to speak at his memorial service. And like all parents, he was far from perfect. And I remember thinking, well, one of the wonderful things he's passed on to me was this commitment to social justice beyond your own narrow needs. And so that was something that I spoke about. And then right around that same time was 9/11, where I was very struck by how quickly our country moved from understandable pain and grief, but without missing a beat, into rage and revenge. And those two things came together for me and led to my decision to leave commercial film and television over a period of time and begin to do something, because I was able to afford it at this point, where I could become a full-time volunteer and use the skill set I have to tell other kinds of stories. And that ultimately led to the documentaries, and then it ultimately led to setting up the Brave New Films and Brave New Foundation.
Very good. I must say something resonated there for me, which is I once made a speech at a college reunion in 1989, and I ended up talking about what are we doing these days to deal with the environment, and ended up you know, haunted by my own words, which it sounds like happened to you as well. How has Brave New Films evolved? In other words, at first, it's you by the seat of your pants putting some stuff together. But at this point, you have, a multi-pronged approach to information, activation, participation, that sort of thing. If you could explain that to listeners.
Sure. Well, we started by doing individual films and then discovered pretty quickly that there were some amazing, talented women and men, and that each film we learned particularly how to work in this universe around content, merging the politics and the personal, and equally important, around distribution. How do you reach an audience in this new changing world where in the middle of early in our work, this new crazy thing called YouTube came out, and we decided to experiment with YouTube. So what we do is we put as much time and energy and staff resources into getting the films or the short videos out into the world as we do into the content. So our multi-pronged approach is essentially one that's constantly looking for the changes. So initially, we did the films. Then with our friends at MoveOn, we initiated the first house parties. Then with the birth of YouTube, we started putting short clips on YouTube. Then early on, we started putting resources into this crazy idea called Facebook, Twitter, social media. Now it's everything. There's no longer one-stop shopping. The way you reach people, whether on their phone or Reddit or Hulu or Netflix or Amazon or our website, is multifaceted. So we go and use all those approaches. And, you know, I know I personally have become almost a lunatic about Twitter. So I'm constantly checking it and seeing what's up there and retweeting things and putting out some of our stuff. But everybody has a different way that they consume information, and, of course, to say nothing of mobile phones. And our job is to make sure that we're not just making good films or good short videos, but that we're reaching people in the way that they consume, which, as I say, the day of one-stop shopping is long gone.
Let me ask you, Robert Greenwald, we're talking about how Brave New Films has evolved to operate in this both a political and a technological environment. What are some of the things you're proud of up to this point? In other words, you've put information out there. Have you had effects from the ripples of what you've done?
Well, in the world that we work in, which is around messaging and information and activating people through our work, it's not as easily measurable as electing a politician.
Sure.
On the other hand, I think it's more important because I think all deep, profound social change starts not with elected officials who are essentially chasing or reactive to the social change or the social movement, but it's building the movement. So I'm enormously pleased that of the work we were able to do around Iraq, where we put out the first film, which really questioned the answers, the so-called answers we have been given about why we went to war. I'm enormously excited that we took on Fox News that nobody had done before, and look what it led to now. You know, I mean, it's as a friend said, it's kind of like we lay down the tracks, and then many others are able to come in. And by the way, we make a great, great effort to work with all of the incredible on-the-ground groups, the organizations, KPFK, of course, you know, and so that it takes a village for social change, and we put time and resources into whatever film it is to make sure that we're working with the people who've been there before and will be there after us. So similarly with Walmart, similarly with Rethink Afghanistan, similarly with the Koch brothers, I think in all those instances we've been able to impact and affect the way people think about something, the way they feel about it, and then helping motivate them to take action. Now, we don't choose one action. I don't think that's our role. I don't think it would be smart. But we work with many, many different groups who have all kinds of action plans.
Very good. That makes a lot of sense to me, actually. In other words, you're working sort of as the media arm, in a way, of a lot of organizations with a lot of different ways of operating.
Exactly right. And that what we do is we say, look, did you know this about Walmart? Or here's this about the Afghanistan war? Or did you know about the Koch brothers? And we do the full films and we do short pieces. And then we make it available to people through our website or Facebook or Twitter or, you know, everything I've mentioned.
Okay, this is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Robert Greenwald of Brave New Films. And we're going to be talking in a few moments about his latest documentary, War on Whistleblowers, Free Press and the National Security State. And to learn more, you can go to waronwhistleblowers.com or bravenewfilms.org. I noticed at the end of War on Whistleblowers a huge list of producers. Could you talk about that? Because that's obviously another way of integrating the Internet.
Yes. Well, we started doing this long before any of the, you know, the current...
crowdfunding?
Yeah. Yes, exactly, where we did it out of desperation, frankly, with Iraq for Sale. We were trying to raise some money. It was very controversial because we were going after the profiteering element. And we wanted to get it out in time for the elections that were coming up. And we knew if we didn't get it done by September, we couldn't force the issue of war profiteering into the elections in November. So we were running out of time. And Jim Gilliam, who was working for me then and has now gone on to start Nation Builder, walked in and said, well, why don't we try to raise money from our list? And I said, oh, you're crazy. Why don't we give money to a film they haven't seen yet and they can't make a profit from? It makes zero sense. But, you know, desperation breeds creativity. So we tried it, and it was very, very successful. It helped fund that film, and it's helped fund many of the films since then. Where listeners like yours put up $5 or $25 or $500 or $5,000, whatever they can afford, and it allows them to participate in the process. It allows them to become a producer, and it allows the discussion and the impact to be changed if we do our job properly.
Right, and now crowdfunding has come along in a way behind you to give you new platforms and ways to do it that are now sort of recognizable to folks rather than... You know, who is this guy asking me for this? Other people are doing it. Brave New Films is somebody I believe in, and they go on from there.
Exactly right. And the people are less reticent.
Yeah.
With the whistleblower film, and over this weekend we're trying to raise money so we can complete our drones movie. So it continues.
Very good. Yeah, that brings me to the next thing, Robert. Robert Greenwald, Brave New Films. In addition to War on Whistleblowers, which we're going to talk about at length and feature two of the whistleblowers in the second half of this show, what are others of your current projects? You just mentioned the drone project, but what else are you guys working on?
Well, the drones is, as you can imagine, I mean, now that Whistleblowers is filmed, we're putting a lot of energy into getting it out there, and of course, all the whistleblowing news, a lot of which I'm happy to say we've been able to impact with the film. But the drones, I took a trip to Pakistan, which we raised funds from listeners like yours, and we now have some amazing, heartbreaking, and powerful interviews with people, drone victims in Pakistan. We're talking to national security experts and former CIA people, so we're in the heavy process of editing that. We also have a relatively new campaign called Beyond Bars, which goes after the fundamentals of mass incarceration and challenges the notion that we can lock up people and be safer. And then we have a third campaign, which has been several years now and increasingly successful, called Cuéntame, Tell Me Your Story, which is oriented to Latino issues and have done tremendous work on immigration and private prisons, and we'll be doing a lot around student debt, which disproportionately affects Latino youth.
And how does the Tell Me Your Story piece fit into that? This is the first I've heard of this one, Robert. So how do individuals telling their story fit into this larger campaign?
Well, the telling the story always does connect the dots. So if telling the story is about immigration, then we try to connect the dots so that people understand systemically who's profiting from immigration policies, where the oppression is coming from, where the crackdowns are coming from. Similarly with private profiteers. But the focus is, as I say, Latino. We just had a big cover on the front of Huffington Post this week about a young girl, Stephanie, who we'd sent a video camera to, and she does an unbelievably heartbreaking, powerful story about her father being taken away from her. You know, my theory always is if you start with the heart, you can reach the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I think too often in the progressive side, we start maybe with a laundry list or a fact or a printout or 7 talking points or 9 pieces of data. But I don't believe you're going to move people that way. And this is where film, of course, is so powerful. You really must reach people's hearts and get the emotions stirring. And then you can reach the thought process, whether it's to activate those who are already with us, which is one kind of work we do, or try to persuade people, as we did with Afghanistan. It's why we called it Rethink, rather than End This Horrible, Awful War.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to reach people who had not thought about it too much and help move them by their emotions and then their brains.
Right, because Afghanistan, as people remember, was the compared to Iraq, it was called, you know, the good one, the one we had a reason for long after there was any reason apparent at all. And so, yeah, I can see where that one is one where you've got to move people from sort of the accepted common wisdom.
Exactly, and particularly, frankly, around national security issues, you have a problem because with the Democratic president, if this were Bush on Afghanistan or this were Bush or Republicans on drones, people would be out in the streets protesting and raising hell. But unfortunately, some folks become too blinded by partisan issues, and I believe, again, looking to social movements, we need to stay true to what we believe in and why we believe in it, and then if we advocate and articulate and move, the politicians will be forced to come along, whoever they are.
Yeah, that's a very good lead into War on Whistleblowers. Before we do that, are you, since you've made the Koch brothers film, are you doing anything around the rumored attempt by the Koch brothers to buy the Tribune Company in the LA Times?
Yes, we've been in discussion with some of our partners and colleagues, and we're trying to be helpful there with some video, some of the pieces from the film. There, as you know, there's more and more ongoing work. So we hope it will. We can help. And there's a section in the film which shows what they do with colleges, where they literally go in and give money to colleges, but demand ideological loyalty in return from professors or who's booked or the syllabus. So there's a good example, and they're pretty open about it. You know, they're not breaking any laws. This is what they do. This is the same thing we would see if they took over the LA Times. They're not buying a newspaper as a business investment.
Right, exactly. Not this day and age.
No.
Okay, I'm speaking with Robert Greenwald. He is the founder and head of Brave New Films. We're about to jump into speaking about his latest documentary, War on Whistleblowers, Free Press and the National Security State. You can learn more at waronwhistleblowers.com or bravenewfilms.org. How did you choose to make this particular documentary? And let me just preface that by saying, obviously, we've heard, you know, voting, media, immigration. There's lots of war. There's lots of issues to choose from. What made this one a film?
Well, every time I make a choice to do a film, it means that we're not doing 19 or 20 or 40 other films.
Exactly.
We take this decision very seriously. We have a whole campaign around war costs, and that's the drone film will be done in that work. We're doing, you know, a series of short pieces. And with Whistleblowers, as I was reading the articles making clear how severe the crackdown was, you know, I got concerned, but it wasn't enough because I didn't feel it was systemic, which is what we always try to do, go after the system itself. And then in doing research and talking to people, it became clear that it wasn't just a general crackdown on whistleblowers. It was a crackdown on national security whistleblowers. And that's when the light bulbs went off, and that's when we said, oh, of course, this is another example of the cost of war, where the national security state, which is fanatic about secrecy to the price of democracy, was exerting its will again. And so we felt that was a connection people weren't aware of, that was an important point we could make, and that would tie into our overriding message that a country perpetually at war is paying a price in many different ways.
And so specifically, why the subtitle, Free Press and the National Security State? Whistleblowers are not members of the press, so what's the connection there?
Well, that evolved as we were doing the research, and it was something we did not know in advance, but every single whistleblower we talked to told a version of the same story. They tried to work within channels. They weren't able to. They went outside, they went to the press, and that's when they were able to have impact and success and change laws or sometimes put themselves in jeopardy. But it was going to the press that made the significant difference. And then we were able to get amazing journalists to be in the film, Jane Mayer and Bill Keller, New York Times, and Dana Priest. And by the way, we should tell your listeners that free copies of the DVD, thanks to a generous donor, are available if you go to our website and have a screening, you know, friends, neighbors, colleagues, whatever, and then send us a photo. So we encourage people to do that. Again, the film is worthless if it's not embraced and taken by people who want to do something and make a difference.
Let me jump in for a quick second here, because if you just tuned in, just caught what he, what Robert Greenwald said, War on Whistleblowers, just getting its sort of its premieres and so on. If you go to the website, waronwhistleblowers.com or bravenewfilms.org, correct, you can find a place to get a free DVD of the film if you commit to hosting a home screening and, what did you say, send a photo or a video into you guys?
Yeah.
Very good. So what most surprised you in the research, and I will link back to what you said about if some of these offenses were going on with a right-wing Republican, you'd have the left and the progressives all over it. They don't seem to be as awake. What did you discover about the role of the Obama administration?
Well, I've discovered, and you're going to hear from the two whistleblowers momentarily, right?
Yep.
They will tell you better than I will how horrific the Obama administration has been, how severe the crackdown has been. And it connects, you know, it connects to the power of the national security state. It connects to a president who has been quoted as saying the CIA gets what it wants. And it connects to a policy that militarizes all problems and starts to make the false equivalency, we need these secrets to protect our troops, which is nonsense. In fact, one of our whistleblowers, Franz Geil, has literally saved lives by blowing his whistle.
Lives of troops. And
of
he
troops.
Is one of the two that will join us in the second half.
Right.
Absolutely.
Well, he's fabulous. And Tom Drake and Tom Tam have shown the laws being broken because of the wiretapping without legal agreement to it. So these men are just, you know, I can't say it strongly enough, truly heroic. We should be giving them parades, and instead they're being attacked by lawyers, in some cases accused of being spies. It's truly horrific. It's runaway military power, and it's lawyers who have gone crazy.
Yeah. The Obama administration has prosecuted more whistleblowers under the Espionage Act of 1917. This 96-year-old law was written to target spies, not journalist sources, and it has prosecuted more whistleblowers under that act than all previous administrations combined.
Yes, exactly. And that's a shocking stat for people. It's important to know. And in the film, we work to interweave these personal human stories to understand why the whistleblowers are doing it and to ask ourselves the question, where do we draw the line? Where would you stand up? What would you be willing to risk in terms of career and comfort level and being attacked by lawyers and legal fees in order to say, I've seen something, it's wrong, and I will not remain silent?
Yeah, when I first decided to do a show on this film, I definitely said to your representatives, I want Robert, but I also want some of the whistleblowers. And I will say this about the film is that you really do get into the personal choices and the personal stakes involved in a way that if I were to close my eyes and picture this, I don't see, you know, statistics. I don't see headlines. I see the faces of the whistleblowers. You track four of them in particular, and so I commend you on that. Now, I will bet that many listeners assume that whistleblowers have legal protections. What is the reality around that issue?
Well, the reality is that the Obama administration did improve legal protections for non-national security whistleblowers, and that's a good thing. But around the national security state, as Franz and Tom will tell you, their protections are minimal or non-existent. And, you know, a team of lawyers, how many, I think Tom says it, how many lawyers, how many dollars wasted? And it's not just the money. think of the resources that were used in going after Franz and Tom and the others that weren't used after going after bad guys, people who really represent a threat to us in some shape or form. And that's really a miscarriage of justice in the truest sense of the word. And that's something, again, that I hope people will screen the film, will talk about. It's not an easy issue. It's not something that immediately jumps out of you, but that's why we took it on. That's why we try to connect the dots so people to continue to understand, you know, a waste of our dollars, breaking of laws, people's lives endangered.
Well, I think the other thing, Robert, is that with this kind of an issue, people won't see it. In other words, the chilling effect of these prosecutions and going after the press and so on means maybe we never hear a story that we would have heard. And so it's very hard for people to get riled up about what they don't know.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. And in fact, we're seeing that now. You know, Jane Mayer from The New Yorker and Dana Priest and Mike Isikoff, I mean, they all talk about how it's gotten harder and harder. And that was before the administration went after the Associated Press,
right?
Before the administration went after the reporter at Fox News. I mean, who would ever think that there'd be anything we would agree with Fox News? You know, what a day is that they've managed to unite Fox and us on this issue. I mean, that takes real, real effort, right?
Yeah, I'm just going to read a couple of things about the AP case. The Department of Justice secretly seized, for any of you who've kind of seen the headlines but not read down, the Department of Justice secretly seized 2 months' worth of private phone records from Associated Press reporters and editors. AP revealed that the phone records seized by the DOJ could bring over 100 employees who use those phone lines, 100 employees under the scope of the investigation, which appears to be focused on a single AP story, May 7th, 2012. The story reported that the CIA disrupted an al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula plot to blow up an airliner. Though it later came out, the plot was actually a sting setup. And in recently confirmed CIA Director John Brennan's own words, we had inside control of the plot and the device was never a threat to the American public. And yet, the DOJ has seized 2 months worth of private phone records. Let me, before we're getting right to the halfway point, we're going to bring in Franz Gehl and Thomas Tamm. You've got some, and you referred to it yourself, some impressive journalists in the film: Isikoff, Keller, Jane Mayer, Dana Priest, etc. How did that come about? Not all of them focus on whistleblowers per se.
Well, it came about because we were in talking to the whistleblowers as they told us their story. They often talked about the particular journalists that they had reached out to. And I thought, you know, that's real filming. If we can have the journalists say, I reached out to Jane Mayer, or the journalists say, I reached out to Mike Isikoff, and then we were able to cut to them to fill it out, that got me excited sort of creatively and politically. And then journalists don't advocate for themselves. So there's a level of discomfort they have that anything that sort of takes a position. But again, this is a very, very important issue to journalists. It's only gotten more important since the film has been out. And I've been pleased to see that, again, the New York Times has been giving more. The last 2 days have been two major stories about what's going on here. And we had many people from the New York Times, both in the film and who attended our screening in New York, including the publisher for the New York Times, came. So, you know, we're able to do something that the papers themselves and the reporters themselves, with all of their power, generally don't do. So we talked to them about the film. We explained what we were doing, and over a period of time, we got them to agree to participate.
Right, and what it does do for me as a viewer is it really links these four cases, four individuals that you focus on, as we said before, to get the personal into it, and then these top flight journalists give us again that systemic view, and it is that point that, okay, these guys are, each of them has an individual case. But what they're talking about is how the very notion of a free press, of a free unbridled press, in the Constitution, you know, one of the foremost things that the Founding Fathers aimed for, is under threat in this kind of an environment.
Well, that's exactly right. And you hit the key word, which is, I've mentioned it and it's worth repeating, which is systemic. That's what we try to do at Brave New Films and Brave New Foundations, with Beyond Bars, with Quentame, with War Cost, with the films. we try to connect the dots so that people understand it's not a question in Walmart of one bad boss. It's not even a question with drones of one bad tactic. It's a problem systemically of capitalism run amok, or it's a problem systemically of a country and an ideology and a profit motive that believes in war. So the more we can make the systemic case, the more we can provide an important function, and the more we can provide tools to listeners like yours who then go out and do something.
So, before I bring them in, how did you choose the cases and individuals that you end up focusing on? You end up focusing on four, Thomas Tamm, Franz Gehl, Tom Drake, and Michael Lefcourt.
Well, it was hard because there were a lot of cases, frankly. So we looked at them from the point of view of relevancy to today, emotional impact. You know, Franz's was easy, right? Here he was saving. I mean, easy,
yeah,
for us to do.
Exactly.
Decision. No question, if it would be malpractice if we didn't use his case, right? Tom Tamm, there was so much about it, from the cover of Newsweek to the fact that his whole family had been in the FBI to the telling us this amazing story about how he discovered that they were listening in on phones that they did not have the legal right to. So over a period of time, the cases that seemed the best from a storytelling and a political point of view emerged. And then we reached out and talked to the various whistleblowers, made sure that they were comfortable and that they would be willing to participate.
Okay, one last question before I take a brief break and bring in the other guests. Why not more in this film about Bradley Manning or WikiLeaks?
I wish. I mean, the problem is you can only do so much in a film without being all over the place, and we made a hard decision that we couldn't take on Bradley Manning and WikiLeaks because they were full films into themselves.
Exactly.
Other films are now being done on
mm-hmm.
them. And so we reference it, and certainly Daniel Ellsberg talks about the importance of that, you know, WikiLeaks and Bradley Manning. But we just were not able to go into it. And I didn't want to do it, you'll pardon me, in a half a way.
So. Right. Not to make it one of the four stories. You know what that would do, and I'm sure you do, was one, it would short shrift Manning and WikiLeaks, and it would sort of overshadow the other three.
Exactly. And I felt that, you know, fortunately, there were going to be films about them and stories about them. So we gave them the respect that they deserve, and we were able to, you know, bring on these guys who you're going to talk to now who were not getting as much attention and who have done an important job.
Very good. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Robert Greenwald of Brave New Films about his latest documentary, War on Whistleblowers, Free Press and the National Security State, and you can learn more and actually get a free DVD if you are willing to host a screening in your home and send Brave New Films a photo attesting that you did so. You can learn more and get those free DVDs. You can go to War on Whistleblowers, one word, waronwhistleblowers.com or bravenewfilms.org. Now I'd like to bring into the conversation two of the four whistleblowers featured in your film, Thomas Tamm and Franz Gehl.
Hello, sir.
Hello. Which one is that?
This is Franz.
Franz and Thomas?
Hi, Thomas Tamm.
Very good. So I'm going to read brief bios for the two of you, introduce you to our audience. We've talked about both of you a bit in the lead up to this, and then we will go into each your individual stories and the meaning you draw from them. Thomas Tamm is a former attorney to the U.S. Department of Justice. He uncovered warrantless wiretapping by the National Security Agency, NSA, under the Bush administration. He was one of the anonymous sources for the New York Times article, Bush Lets U.S. Spy on Callers Without Courts, in 2005, which led to an enormous publicity, attention, and a criminal investigation. Tamm eventually told his full story to Newsweek's Michael Isikoff in 2008. And for his whistleblowing, Thomas Tamm was awarded the Ridenour Prize for Truth-Telling in 2009. Franz Gehl, while working at the Pentagon as a science advisor for the Marine Corps, he was a Marine, he volunteered to deploy to Iraq. And upon his return, he alerted the Office of the Secretary of Defense, later the Congress and the media, to critical equipment shortages. Vice President Joe Biden has acknowledged Gehl's central role in raising the visibility of these needs And yet, Gail has been the target of years of retaliatory investigations and workplace harassment. Could you tell us, in your own words, very briefly, a bit about your personal path up to the point of your whistleblowing? In other words, you know, any movie, any story has the backstory, and then something happens which sends us in a new direction. What was the life up till that inciting incident that led you to become whistleblowers? First, Thomas Tam.
Well, I come from a background of law enforcement. My father actually was in the FBI. My brother was a career special agent in the FBI, and I had been a prosecutor and had joined the United States Department of Justice in their death penalty unit. I was the only attorney in the unit that was opposed to the death penalty. But after 9/11, we had the opportunity to meet with families, victims' families in New York, and it inspired me or motivated me to go to try and go after the terrorist who had attacked my country. So I transferred in the Department of Justice to the what was then called the Office of Intelligence Policy and Review, and it was where we conducted what I thought were legal wiretaps to listen to people that we thought might be related to terrorist agents.
Okay. Franz Gehl, your life prior to becoming or witnessing those events that led you to become a whistleblower.
Well, I've been a Marine my entire adult life. When I was 16, I dropped out of high school. I was really a loser kid, really going nowhere. The Marines were still taking such kids in 1974, and that has become my entire identity since. I owe everything to the Marine Corps. They've given me the character foundation that has benefited me my whole life. I was in for 3 years after my, almost 5 years after my 17th birthday when I came in. Got out as a sergeant, went to school, came back as an officer because I missed the Marine Corps, and I was in as an infantry officer until I retired in 2002. I got up to the rank of major. Couldn't get promoted past that, which is fine, but I still wanted to be a Marine. So I was brought back as a civil servant. While I was on active duty, I'd been sent to graduate school, learned some things about their technical, and I was brought back as a science and technology advisor. And I was doing very well. I mean, they even promoted me twice as a civilian. Coming back, I left as a major, and I came back as a GS-15. That's like a double promotion. And so, I mean, the Marine Corps has been extremely good to me. And they sent me to grad school again in 2006, just before I went to Iraq. I guess things go extremely well when all your time, you've never been critical of your own organization. If I had had a reason, maybe I would have been, but I've always been, you know, a motivated Marine as a civilian and when I was on active duty. Finding fault in all others, but never my Marine Corps.
Sure.
Well, things changed when I went to Iraq, and you've heard a little bit about that story, and discovered some very ugly things that were, in fact, costing lives unnecessarily. And so I tried to get up through my chain of command to the officer of the Secretary of Defense, but I was actually stopped. I went to the office anyways. I went around my chain of command. That's where my problem started, but I was stopped by my own chain. The reason was is because what I was revealing was, in fact, what could be perceived as the leadership of the Marine Corps at certain levels and certain commands having the blood of their own Marines on their hands, which, in fact, if there is such a thing in that concept, is true. And there's no way that the Marine Corps is going to allow that to be outed. That's taking something outside the family that you never take outside the family. Well, in my opinion, it was more important to take it outside the family to fix it. And so the loss of lives, the continuing tragedy, was much more important than any embarrassment it might be the come on the Marine Corps for exposing it.
Okay, Franz, since you've jumped into the whistleblowing chapter, let me ask a couple of questions. One, first of all, what is it that you discovered that they were not doing right that might cost servicemen's lives?
The Marines in Iraq for several years had been requesting very specific pieces of equipment that they knew and had done their own research were going to mitigate casualties. The biggest one, there were many, but the biggest one, most important one, was the mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicle, South African design, old Rhodesian design, that was superior to the Humvee, that is the popular piece of ground transport for the military.
And when you say superior, what I take from the film is like night and day.
Night and day, is, and it's most recently been confirmed by the Department of Defense itself. The MRAP, as it's nicknamed, is 13 times more survivable than the Humvee, the armored Humvee, when attacked by these bombs. It's so over the top, off the chart superior. It's insane that this was not realized long before the war in Iraq. In fact, the Marines and the Army knew in the early 90s that the Humvee, the armored Humvee, was a death trap against such bombs. And so it was crystal clear. It was obvious that was the choice for the type of combat environment the Marines were finding themselves in.
Right, where most of our casualties come from IEDs, from running into
exactly.
IEDs.
At that time, and I think the figure is actually, you know, the movie states 30%. It was actually far above 60%, maybe even above 70% of the casualties in Iraq were from IEDs.
And when you say casualty, that doesn't just mean death. That means the folks who suffered the maiming and the horrible head injuries that they will be living with and we will be paying for the rest of their lives.
Traumatic brain injury, burns, amputations, the awful maiming that has been done to so many of our service members, certainly the Marines, but the other services as well. It's just awful. And that will be with those young kids who are now young kids for the rest of their lives.
Right. And also for taxpayers, which is not, you know, obviously what happens to those individuals is the paramount issue. But for taxpayers, the costs of that, of both of these wars, where the casualties are mostly IEDs, will be with the taxpayers for the next 50 years.
Indeed it will, and it'll be a high cost if the taxpayers are doing the right thing in terms of giving the attention to our wounded warriors that they should be.
Now, you point out that the services knew the differences. They knew the superior piece of equipment. What happened? Why weren't they using them?
Well, the reason is because there was no business case for this new vehicle to be purchased. The business case was in what we already had. And tremendous industry power behind that, as well as the linkages to the government and the Pentagon. AM General is the builder of the Humvee. They've made so many of these things, I think they're almost in the realm of countless, and not just for the United States, but other foreign sales. These things have been the staple ever since the M151 Jeep. We all used to have the Jeep. Ever since that went away in the 1980s, we've had the Humvee. When you suddenly are calling out our staple vehicle across the military as being unsafe in combat, I mean, that's unacceptable. There's no way anyone is going to allow that to fly. You're going to go ahead and try and cover up that fact and push away some superior design like MRAP just to keep the story alive that we're doing the right thing.
I see. So, because that was my question, which is when you said, you know, it was more important for me to get the word out and that's not going to work and so on, unless they had been responsive. In other words, there is the possibility, I thought, that the other way this story goes is you report this, they follow it up, they find out, you know, it's backed up by research and evidence, and they gradually or transition and make the changes. But that is not what happened.
No, there were several very senior general officers in the Marine Corps who, and some of them, one especially, just recently retired, who were responsible for the decisions and the oversight of the organization that turned away those needs at the time. Whether he was, you know, asleep at the switch or whether he was a part of the decision to push these things away, either way, the embarrassment for the Marines would have gone all the way to the top. So they could not admit it themselves. The best thing to do was to shoot me, shoot the messenger.
Right.
Of course, I took, you know, I've been trained as a Marine, so I understand combined arms, okay? I took gasoline and I threw it all over that fire. and got it totally illuminated through the press and through Congress. There was no way they could push back on that request anymore. And that's essentially what happened.
So I want you to tell me what happened after you blew the whistle, and then we'll get to you, Thomas Tam. But first I want to tell people this is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. The voices of those I'm speaking with are Thomas Tam and Franz Gale. Currently speaking to Franz Gale. They are both whistleblowers featured in the new Brave New Films documentary, War on Whistleblowers, Free Press and the National Security State. And it highlights the stories of four whistleblowers. Franz and Thomas are two of them. And you can learn more at waronwhistleblowers.com or bravenewfilms.org. Sticking with you, Franz, and then we'll go to you, Thomas. So what happened? You've gotten nothing accomplished by going through channels. You then, as you say, threw fire on it. What happened then?
Yeah, I went around the chain of command. So that gave my commanders, but I did it in plain sight. I didn't do it, you know, anonymously or anything. It was my choice. I could have done that too, but I decided to do it in plain sight because I was dealing with my Marine Corps culture as I thought was appropriate. So I did it in plain sight. I told my supervisors I was going to Congress. I told them that I had spoken to the press. I went on the record on the press, et cetera, et cetera. Well, of course, there's going to be immediate consequences. They started out with formal counselings and formal reprimand, then a formal proposal for suspension, personnel improvement programs, bottom feeder in terms of all respects of my performance evaluations. I had several advocates that came to my assistance that Robert knows well, and they're just wonderful. Project on Government Oversight, the Government Accountability Project. So I was really lucky. I had a lot of support early on that kind of fended off. But finally, a few years later, they finally found a way to go after my security clearance. That's the way you get national security whistleblowers. You go after their security clearance, define them as unreliable, untrustworthy, having poor judgment. As soon as you do that, there's no court of appeal, at least yet, and you can get rid of them that way. That's the way they went after me.
So what that does is that basically takes you out at the knees and makes it impossible for you to continue in the career that you're in.
Exactly. I'm no longer able to accomplish the job that I'm hired for. I was kicked out of the sensitive facility I worked in. I was kicked out of the Pentagon. I was put on administrative leave for over a year. And so I was doing nothing for over a year. But again, my advocates, and again, I've been very lucky, and I think Thomas has had some benefits from these guys as well. They're wonderful. Gap and Pogo are wonderful.
Right. Let me just give people those websites because I did want to do that. So this is the Project and Government Oversight, Pogo, and the Government Accountability Project, Gap. Both of these are very active supporting whistleblowers, supporting the free flow of information. And their websites are pogo.org and whistleblower.org. So those are pretty easy to remember. So that's what the repercussions on you. Ultimately, they followed your advice. When did that happen?
Well, the Secretary of Defense already knew, his name, Robert Gates, already knew that MRAPs, by different channels, he had already realized that MRAPs were the right thing to do. What he didn't know at the time was that they were being obstructed at the lower levels, at the service levels where it happened, especially in the Marine Corps. And by throwing fire on it and getting in the press, he suddenly realized, hey, wait a second, my intent is not being followed. I know these vehicles are good, but the services are obstructing it. And he immediately made the MRAP a top priority for the procurement project for the DOD and forced the issue. And the services ended up, I think they produced probably 25,000 MRAPs faster. This has been, according to the movie, and it makes entire sense from the costs involved, like a $45 billion program. One of the biggest programs, or the biggest program since World War II, a crash program. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, it was managing to connect the dots so that everyone is aware. You throw gasoline on it, you create a lot of light, and then suddenly things start to move.
So, good was finally done as you had hoped. And what have been the where do you stand today? What have been the repercussions on your life as we look now? Franz Gale.
I've been very lucky. I consider my luck exceptional. I have not the others like Tom and Tom Drake and others. I've just been lucky. That's all I can say. I've been brought back to work because the advocacy efforts worked, and the Merit Service Protection Board ordered the Marines to bring me back to work. So I'm back at work. I have my clearance back. Everything got returned to me, almost everything.
How many years did you lose?
I didn't lose any years because they paid me the whole time. The Marines were bold enough to send me home on administrative leave and strip me of my clearances and then try to fire me a couple times, but they never stopped my pay. So I didn't suffer as badly as others have.
Okay, that's Franz.
Bob McLean, a TSA whistleblower who you can hear about otherwise, that man has been without pay. Hopefully he will get it all back. But I was lucky.
Okay, that's the voice of Franz Gehl. We're now shifting to Thomas Tamm. Thomas is the DOG person who broke the story that the U.S. was spying on phone messages, phone calls, without warrants from the courts. Thomas, your story. And let me tell you, you've got basically 5 minutes. What I want you to cover is what happened, what the repercussions were, in terms of the issue and what the repercussions have been to you?
Well, I mean, what happened was the longer I worked in the government, I figured out that first of all, the CIA saw that we were engaging in rendering people for torture. And then when I went to the wiretapping court, I, as Franz said, I kind of connected some dots and figured out that there was a separate track that kind of avoided basically the court, and that there was electronic surveillance of Americans without obtaining legal authorization. I asked a few too many questions, and the very secret unit that I was in was told that people didn't ask questions, that they just assumed that it was illegal. And I consider myself, as I told you at the top, a law enforcement agent. So I went up to a friend I knew on the Congress and said, I need to know, is the co-equal branch of government, are they aware of this warrantless wiretapping? And basically, I was stonewalled and was told that whistleblowers don't come out very well. So I waited a little bit longer and then decided to go to the New York Times, noticed Eric Litchblau was covering the Department of Justice, met with him over a period of time, and he informed me that James Risen, a colleague, had other sources from the CIA and the NSA, and basically we put together the fact that there was large-scale warrantless wiretapping going on that was clearly illegal. It's been found to be illegal by three different federal courts. I was basically kind of forced out of the Department of Justice, was without a job for quite a period of time, have just opened my own law office and doing criminal defense, but in August of 2007, 18 agents raided my home, early morning hours, awakened my kids, scared my wife, took all of my computers and personal records and even my Christmas card list and cell phones. And 2 days later, I was offered the opportunity to plead guilty to an espionage charge that would contemplate me going to jail.
Yeah, and by the way, notice that's espionage. For pointing out that that there was warrantless wiretapping going on, you are being offered the chance to plead guilty to a charge of spying against your country.
Correct. And I didn't think I had done anything wrong. In fact, I thought the people that were doing the warrantless wiretapping, silly me, I thought they should be investigated and prosecuted. So I turned it down, and for a year and a half longer, I was followed, and I'm sure my phone was listened to, and I know I was physically followed, and I know my emails were read. And finally, I just got to the point where, against legal advice, and I had to spend a lot of money for a lawyer. I did not know about Gap and Pogo at the time. I've since learned, and they've been very helpful, but I didn't know that I could go to them. I just had my own attorney and had a lot of friends help me pay some of those expenses. But I, against legal advice, decided to meet with Mike Isikoff and basically lay out the entire thing and say, here's what I did. If you can prove me guilty of something, you know, go for it. And I honestly thought that in, that was published, I believe, in 2008, just in, honestly thought that when a new administration came in that they would say that there had been a mistake and they appreciated me pointing out the fact that something illegal was being done, and like Franz, offered my job back, but that's not how it has played out.
Right. No, one thing that we see in this film is we really, I think, as much as anything, especially with you and Tom Drake, I think, we see just the choice you made and the cost that it has had, and that both of you, I think, thought a new administration, things will change, and that's what we talked about, what I talked about with Robert at the start, which is that the Obama administration, rather than reversing course, has doubled down on fighting whistleblowers and chilling the press. We've got to bring it to a close right now. I really appreciate both of you taking the time on a Sunday on Memorial Day weekend to spend this time with us. The film is War on Whistleblowers, Free Press in the National Security State. To learn more, you can go to waronwhistleblowers.com or bravenewfilms.org. A free DVD of the film is available to people who commit to hosting a home screening and then sending them a photo proving that you did. Thank you to Thomas Tam and Franz Gehl, not just for your time this weekend, but for the courageous and self-sacrificing whistleblowing that you both and the others featured in the film did for the better of the rest of us. Keep up your good work. For this week's conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally, TerrenceMcNally.net, or A World That Just Might Work, oneword.com. They're both the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and three or four articles of background, sign up at my site or email me at TEMcNally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to Free Forum podcast at my site or on iTunes. Thanks to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi in production, and to you, my listeners, I look forward to being with you again next week.